are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, January 28th, 2019. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Assistant Professor of Government at Cornell University, Jamila Meichner. On our fragmented democracy, Medicaid, federalism, and unequal politics. Also on the program today, the government's reopened for 3 weeks, and labor is who we should thank. Meanwhile, Kamala Harris announces a plutocrat dabbles, and Wall Street freaks out about Warren and Sanders. Nancy Pelosi says, no State of the Union yet. We'll see if you're a good boy. U.S. and Taliban in peace talks. Meanwhile, the Trump administration warns of the gathering Venezuelan threat to the United States. And good news. New Mexico advances voting rights for ex-felons. New York State protects trans rights. North Carolina will get another Democratic state Supreme Court justice. Lastly, Massachusetts Attorney General going after the Sackler family.
Don't be premature about that.
For their role in engineering the opioid crisis. All this and more on today's program, ladies and gentlemen. You know, the Sackler thing is really, it's fascinating, and hopefully we'll get to it. But we've spoken, particularly when we go to Vegas for the tort lawyer shows, we've heard quite a bit about the opioid crisis. And I think most of the attorneys I've talked to there have been going after the distributors. There are three major distributors. They have a statutory responsibility to report back to the U.S. government when they see spikes and unaccounted for spikes in prescription drugs going to specific regions of the country, which is exactly what that was. Nevertheless, we've heard a lot about the Sacklers. And I went to the Brooklyn Museum this weekend, Sackler Wing. And you're just like, I could not go into the wing, or I could sit down with my kids and say, this is why we're not going into that wing. But it is sort of fascinating. It is a, the wing there had an exhibit, and I don't know, I think it's like a, it's been there for a while, this exhibit. On feminist artwork, which is, you know, the way that I guess they make themselves feel better on some level.
Did they sponsored the dinner party? Is that where that wing
yeah,
is?
Exactly. Wow. That whole wing. And you want to go up to, you know, you're like, you're just looking around like, there's no, what am I going to do here? Like, I wanted to go up to the security guard and go like, I'm not taking my kids in here because of the Sacklers. And he would have just looked at me like,
be like, all right. He would be like, I think we might have a problem here.
No, it's not even that. It would just be like, yeah, okay. What I have no idea what you're talking about. The restroom's right down the hall.
Recommend the gift shop.
But their money is everywhere. And that is, I mean, there's a lot of that going on right now, of course, you know, with Davos and the sort of greater understanding of the cost of philanthropy and what it does to our society, et cetera, et cetera. But A good weekend insofar as Donald Trump caved. We were on the air Friday when that happened. And I just want to, you know, make this clear. I think the Democrats did a good job in not screwing this up. I think Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer, Pelosi obviously was a positive force, and Chuck Schumer was smart enough to sort of recede. And you know, and a lot of this was successful because Chuck goaded him into saying, "I'll own the shutdown." And I think that was a moment that Donald Trump would like to take back. And I think Chuck Schumer is very proud of himself about that, and good for him. But largely understand this. What the Democrats did was they managed not to screw it up, and good for them. They deserve credit for that. But on Friday, 5 minutes into the show, there were reports that LaGuardia, that Miami, and I think Philadelphia airports had to suspend flights for an hour or something. And it was obviously a work action by some of the air traffic controllers. Simultaneously, the flight attendant union put out a statement saying, in response to the FAA staffing shortages, Sarah Nelson, the president of the flight attendants union, said this is exactly what AFA and other aviation unions have been warning about would happen. The aviation system depends on the safety of the professionals who run it. They've been doing unbelievably heroic work, even as they are betrayed by the government that employs them. They're fatigued, worried, and distracted, but they won't risk our safety, so the planes will stay on the ground. This is anything but a sick out. It's only about our safety and the air traffic controller's absolute commitment to it. Do we have your attention now, Leader McConnell? All lawmakers, open the government and get back to business and democracy to discuss whatever issue you so choose. Shutdown must end immediately. This is the unions associated with the airports basically threatening, we're going to go all in on this. There's solidarity, and this is a veiled threat. It was not a glib one, and it was certainly substantiated by, with reality. But it was goes beyond a threat. It's a promise. Like, look, you know, you drop a hammer off of a building, it's going to fall to the ground. That's what's going to happen. Gravity is going to work here. And we said at the first 10 minutes into the show on Friday, I was like, this is probably going to end by the weekend. Because this is the beginning of the end of those people who work at airports who are gonna continue to take this. And once the airports go, forget it. Within 3 hours, the government shutdown was over. So and from day one on the shutdown, I think we said literally from day one, it's the airports. Because that's the moment where you start to shut down the government functioning for the wealthy people in a really explicit way, and B, because it is such an easily digestible, it's a national story. You can see it. If you're in New York City, you can see it when Atlanta shuts down their airport. And so make sure that you that credit is where credit is due on this. This was a labor victory. This was about labor power. And it just bookmark this in your minds, folks, because this is indicative of what labor can do. Meanwhile, Mick Mulvaney, trying to make the best out of a really bad situation for the administration. I mean, this is, they really lost this one in a big, big way.
They didn't even come out of this with any of the spin. Just lost. It was just a pure unmitigated L.
Yes. But here's how they're going to salvage it. I mean, this is the most anemic thing I've ever heard. And I can just imagine, like, the idea that they think anybody takes this threat seriously. Look, Donald Trump may go out there and declare a national emergency to fund the wall, but it'll set an interesting precedent. because I don't think he has any other emergencies he's going to see outside of maybe, you know, Venezuela. But certainly there's some emergencies, I think, on the left that people envision. And if Wall Street's worried right now about an Elizabeth Warren or Bernie Sanders coming into office, wait till they have the emergency powers that Donald Trump is going to provide for them. That should be rather interesting. All right, here is Mick Mulvaney. Let's just keep the picture up, right? We're just going to keep the picture up? Oh, okay. Are you going to keep it on me? All right. Yeah, this is CBS, so we're just going to listen to the audio because they get very uptight about people seeing the images of Mick Mulvaney and who was the host?
Margaret Brennan. You're not missing anything.
All right, but here are the pictures of them.
Is the president really prepared to shut down the government again in 3 weeks?
Yeah, I think he actually is.
No,
keep
he's
in
not.
Mind,
no,
he's willing to do whatever it takes to secure the border. He does take this very seriously. This is a serious humanitarian and security crisis.
Pause it.
And as
I mean, if we were to believe this, why did he start the government back up? Yeah. If he's willing to do anything that it takes, wait, what?
Just save
is there a
few
follow
jobs.
Up on this question?
Save let's a few get, jobs.
Here.
President of the United States, he takes the security of the nation as his highest priority. He doesn't want to shut the government down. Let's make that very clear. He doesn't want to declare a national emergency. What he wants to do is fix this the way that things are supposed to get fixed with our government, which is through legislation. One of the reasons he agreed to open the government this week was to essentially take the Democrats at their word. While their leadership had been telling us they were not interested in negotiating and they were sort of taking this do-nothing and hope the president gives up approach, there were many, many Democrats, both rank and file, and some lower levels of leadership would come to us and say, look, we happen to agree with you on border security.
Yeah, good luck with that. Good luck with that. I think that's the most anemic thing I've ever seen.
That's also, I mean, even Maggie Haberman had this piece in the Times, I think it dropped yesterday, about how Jared Kushner actually thought, because he was able to move this small and, you know, I guess credit where credit is due, justice reform bill through the House and Senate and have Trump sign it, that all of a sudden he was now like the deal maker and the Democrat whisperer. And she just, you know, in very like polite Times language was like, he really underestimated the extent to which rank and file Democrats back their leadership and their position. seemed to kind of catch him off guard.
Well, it's only been 2 years,
right,
since they've been in office.
Right.
They're still neophytes.
Yeah.
Well, and they haven't quite figured out how Washington works.
Right. I guess Kushner's been talking to Mick Mulvaney.
Folks, has your company outgrown QuickBooks? Are shared spreadsheets, manual processes, and legacy systems costing you time and money? Introducing NetSuite by Oracle. It's the business management software that handles every aspect of your business in an easy-to-use cloud platform. With NetSuite, you can save time, money, and unneeded headaches by managing sales, human resources, finance, and accounting instantly right from your desk, even from your phone. Thousands of the best-known and fastest-growing companies use NetSuite to manage their business. Now it's available to you. Better yet, it's more affordable than you think. Because right now, NetSuite is offering you valuable insights to help you overcome the obstacles that are holding you back free. Don't miss out on unleashing your business's full potential with this free guide, Crushing the Five Barriers to Growth. You'll learn how to acquire new customers, increase profits, and finally get real visibility into your cash flow. Get NetSuite's guide, Crushing the Five Barriers to Growth.
I'm into it.
At netsuite.com/majority now. That's netsuite.com/majority to download their free Crushing the Five Barriers to Growth guide today. netsuite.com/majority. And folks, every 2 seconds, there's a new victim of identity theft, which means a criminal could be spending your money, applying for loans in your name, and even damaging your credit, the good credit you've worked on so hard to build. Unfortunately, you can miss certain threats to your identity by just checking bank statements and monitoring your credit. Good thing there's LifeLock Identity Theft Protection. LifeLock uses proprietary technology to detect and alert you to a wide range of identity threats, like your Social Security number, for sale on the dark web. I checked out my dark web through this. I'm clean.
Nice.
But it's, and I got to say, I was shocked because I've gotten about a half a dozen over the past like 3 years, half a dozen like from, I don't know if it was, I don't want to say the company, but I think it was my medical insurance company was like, oh, we had this light hack. And it's possible your social security number could
be out
there.
How often they give you those messages? Like, nothing to worry about here.
Experian? I mean,
our entire system was compromised.
Just covering our ass.
Frankly, you should be able to, there should be massive lawsuits about this. And then they say, oh, but we'll give you a free 6 months of, you know, some type of security protection or something. Meanwhile, it's too late. If you do have an issue involving identity theft, one of LifeLock's identity restoration specialists will work to fix it. Of course, no one can prevent all identity theft or monitor all transactions at all businesses, but with LifeLock, you get identity theft protection and additional features to help protect your device against cyber threats for as low as $9.99 a month. Don't waste another second. Visit LifeLock.com/majority now to save an extra 10% on your first year. That's LifeLock.com/majority for an extra 10% off. LifeLock.com/majority. Check it out, folks. Identity theft, super scary. And anybody, I have never experienced it. I have had a family member deal with it, and the mop-up is a huge pain in the butt. Having someone who can walk you through that and be dogged for you, extremely helpful. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, be talking to Jamila Meichner on fragmented democracy, Medicaid, federalism, and unequal politics. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program Assistant Professor of Government from Cornell University, Jamila Meichner. She is the author of Fragmented Democracy, Medicaid, Federalism, and Unequal Politics. Jamila, did I pronounce your last name correctly?
It's Meichner. You are pretty close.
All right. Well, I apologize. Welcome to the program, and thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So, all right, let's just start with, for folks who don't know, like, give us a sense of where Medicaid fits in as a program in the structure of government-sponsored health insurance.
Sure. So we don't have any sort of universal government-sponsored health insurance that anyone and everyone can have access to. Instead, what we have is the government helping various subsets of people who have very specific needs and fall into very specific categories. So we have Medicare, which is for elderly people who are over 65, so that you know you can get health insurance in your old age. And we have, for example, the VA, which is a government agency that provides health insurance and benefits to our veterans. And then we have Medicaid, which is a program that provides health insurance predominantly to low-income Americans, right? So people who are poor and lack resources. Now, that's not in every state. There are some states where you can be as poor as you like and you wouldn't get health insurance. But in many states, if you're at 133% of the poverty line or below, you can have access to Medicaid. And the vast majority of people who rely on Medicaid are living in poverty or very near poverty. And many of those people are also elderly. And so Medicaid covers what Medicare doesn't. And they are also disabled and have other kinds of health challenges. So Medicaid is the program that really provides health insurance for the most vulnerable, most needy people in the country.
And we should say, I mean, just to correct me if I'm wrong, but the VA is also not just provides health insurance, but they these are government paid doctors, essentially, and hospitals.
Yeah.
Okay. And so that is when people say government run health and health care, we have it. I mean, that is basically it. We just happen to only provide it to our vets. And my understanding is too that the VA actually Elizabeth Warren came out with a proposal recently to produce generic drugs in certain instances by the government. The VA does that now when there are shortages. They're pretty much all in there. So let's start with this idea of how now Medicare is. How is Medicare different from Medicaid? Well, I guess maybe I should ask that second. So let's talk about first about Medicaid and that fragmented nature. I don't think people realize how not federally directed Medicaid is. And I apologize for not for doing that like with a double negative, I guess. But explain to us if I'm eligible for Medicaid and go through a state where I may not even get, there may be no eligibility for me, through to a state where maybe they've accepted the expansion of Medicaid under the ACA. Where does the federal, direction end in terms of that flow of health insurance to a recipient?
Yeah, that's a great question. So the federal government sets the broadest kinds of contours for Medicaid as a health insurance provider, right? So there are some really large categories of things that every state who covers Medicaid beneficiaries, which is every state, has to provide, right? And there are certain categories of people that every state has to cover. And so, you know, pregnant women who are living below the poverty line can receive Medicaid in every state, right? And they can receive coverage for their pregnancy. However, what other things they receive coverage for might vary from state to state. So even if you're a pregnant woman who's eligible for Medicaid in any state, right, let's say that you live in, you know, Alabama, you will get coverage for your pregnancy and for some things directly related to it, but you might not get physical therapy if you have an injury, and you might not get glasses if you're unable to see. You might not get your teeth taken care of if you have a dental problem, because those things, podiatry, vision, those are optional. And states can decide whether they want to offer those things to any of their Medicaid beneficiaries or whether they want to offer them to all of them. And they have lots and lots of leeway, of discretion. Now, there are some states that haven't expanded Medicaid. And in those non-expansion states, there are still 14 states that haven't adopted the expansion. And in those states, you can be very, very poor in many of those states and not qualify for Medicaid if, for example, you're a childless adult, or even if you're an adult with children in some cases. In the states that have expanded Medicaid, so the other 37 states, everyone who lives at 133 or below of the poverty line is eligible. But even in those states, whether you've expanded or not, states still get to make really specific choices about what they'll cover and what they'll not, that they won't. All states have to cover some basic suite of things. But then all states also have a ton more choice in terms of what they provide and what they don't.
Now, my understanding has always been that the reason why we would not want, from the perspective of someone who wants as many people as possible covered by health insurance, the reason why we would not want the federal government to block grant money to the states would be that it would the rate in which the increase of health care would not be covered, and that two, the state could use it, could redirect money. Like, how, what is the relationship between the money that the federal government makes available and the state? So when you say the state says, like, oh, we will not cover podiatry, for instance, is that, are they getting the same amount of money per potential recipient as another state that may offer podiatry, and they just simply decide, oh, we're gonna put it on respiratory stuff as opposed to podiatry? I mean, how does that work? How does the state restrict in that fashion?
Yeah, so, you know, what Medicaid, in terms of the funding, you know, the federal government allocates or matches a certain amount of money, and it varies across states, and it depends on how much the states spend, and it also depends on the states themselves, for example, and how high poverty is in the states and a number of other factors. But the federal government essentially will cover, there's a kind of, it's called the Federal Medical Assistance Percentage, the FMAP multiplier, but it's the kind of the percentage that the federal government uses and determines that they will match and cover of all that the state spends. So, you know, states have to make decisions, because it is true that the more that they spend, the more that the federal government will cover for them. But then they're left covering the remaining percentage of the cost for Medicaid beneficiaries. So, the less they spend total, the less their leftover percentage is. And, you know, how much that percentage is varies from state to state. And so states have to make pretty complicated decisions about how much they can afford to spend and how much they're currently spending. You know, the thing about the real challenge with block grants is that, you know, states right now, you know, treat Medicaid as, and Medicaid is, it's really an entitlement. So states have a lot of decisions to make about who's eligible and who's not. But once they make decisions about who's eligible, every single person in that state who's eligible gets the benefit. And that's because no matter how much a state spends, the state can decide everybody's eligible below this certain amount. And right now that amount is 133. So even the states that have the most generous eligibility requirements, they decide we're going to be generous. The federal government will match that up until the place where they say they will, which is 133. And so those states can be really generous, and they can count on the federal government to match their share, to cover the share that they said that they will. And they have to cover the rest. But everyone in that state who qualifies based on those eligibility criteria will get Medicaid. That's what really an entitlement means. It doesn't mean anybody feels like they're entitled to anyone, anything. It just means everyone who fits the criteria gets the benefit. If we were to block grant Medicaid, states would have a capped amount, right? And that capped amount would increase over time, but it wouldn't increase at the rate of cost. And it would mean that when states ran out of money, when they ran out of the money that the federal government gave them, they ran out and there's no more money left. And so one of the things that happens under those circumstances is that people stop getting the benefit. It's not something that you get because you're eligible anymore. You get it if you're lucky enough to get it before the state runs out of the bundle of money that the federal government has given them. And so that often will mean that states have to pull back, that they have to offer less, that they have to cover fewer people. And then there's the big problem of right now, you know, states get compensated based on what they spent. But if states just get a fixed amount and it's given to them, right, there's an incentive there. Well, now we know that we're getting, you know, whatever the amount is, you know, we're getting $1 billion from the federal government. Let's try to find ways of spending less, right? Now we have a surplus, and maybe we can do some other things with this. Maybe we can redirect it. We know that's what happened with TANF, with the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families, when it got block granted. Now, states just get a big old pile of money, and they start getting creative about how they use that money, and they use less and less of it for the core purpose of the program. So that we know now states are using TANF funds to do all sorts of things, to fund scholarships, from college scholarships for middle-class and upper-middle-class students. You know, they just make up reasons to spend the money on things that they want to, because block grants give them even more flexibility than they already have. Fewer resources to help people with, but more flexibility to misuse those resources.
Right. Okay. And so we should, in some respects, just to restate, in some ways right now, Medicaid is like an economic stabilizer, like food stamps. There is a formula as to who is eligible. And if you have, let's say, a financial crisis and more people lose their jobs and more people dip into poverty, more people are going to be eligible and the money will be there because the program will expand with the need, as opposed to the need being constrained by whatever we decide is an arbitrary number that we're going to fulfill that need with.
Yes.
Okay. And so
That's exactly right.
And then the block grants on top of that not only have that problem, but as you say, can easily be diverted by states that don't have an interest in providing for the least fortunate in their state. It's easy to pick out at least 14 right now that are almost openly hostile to those people based upon their refusal to pick up the expansion. But all right, so how is that different from as it is now, where you have a state that says, like, okay, we're going to take care of X number of our people, and we can't exactly say how many of those people there are, but we're going to set the formula at such a place where we anticipate it'll cover about X number of people. And the federal money will cover 80% of that, let's say, or 90% of that. And we'll have to make up that 10%. We can have that line item in the budget. It'll make it look like we're humane people to some respect. How is Medicare different? Is Medicare is that parceled out by the state as well, or is that a direct federal benefit?
Medicare is a federal benefit. So with Medicaid, it's intergovernmental. The states are covering part. The federal government is covering part. And how much varies across states depending on several factors, but it really is a shared responsibility between the states and the federal government. Medicare is not a shared responsibility. The states do share some responsibility in terms of administering Medicare, right? So if you are an elderly person and you have a problem with your Medicare, there's a local office that you can go to talk to someone about it, and that's in your state. So states help with administration. But when it comes to where the funding for the program is coming from, it's coming from the center. It's coming from the federal government. And what that means is that, A, that it's more generous, B, that it's more reliable. It's much more difficult for Medicare to fluctuate, whereas with Medicaid, it goes up and down with state budgets. When states are having a hard time, when they're in some sort of an economic recession or having some sort of financial trouble, they can cut Medicaid. It's an option because there's a portion of it, a large chunk of it, that they're directly in control of. Medicare doesn't work like that. It's a much more stable and reliable program because its structure is nationally based and not federated in the same way that Medicaid is.
Okay. And your research, we started getting closer to like the heart of your research in terms of what that difference in that dynamic does to people's perspective on the program and in government more broadly. Why is it that way? Like, why, when these two programs were developed, was there this distinction?
So this has been a part of the kind of broader struggle around providing people who have needs in the United States with what they need. You know, the way that we approach helping people, whether it's with their health needs or other core social needs in this country, has always been pretty piecemeal and fragmented. And so there are some groups of people that are viewed as desirable, and we want to help them, and we want to help them in ways that are generous, in ways that are consistent, in ways that are equitable and fair. And there are, and elderly people fall into that category, right? Who doesn't think of most elderly people as the kind of, you know, group that you want to help? Nobody wants to see old people sick or struggling or living in poverty. And so they're a sympathetic group that, you know, for a long time, American social policy has been oriented towards helping, and helping in the most stable, equitable way possible. Now, other groups of people, for example, people who are just poor. They may not be elderly, they may not be sympathetic in any other way, but they're poor, they lack resources. And our general policy approach in this country towards people who are living in poverty is that we want to give them, we tend to give them as little as possible, and we tend to have programs that help those people vary a lot across space. We want states to have a lot of choice, a lot of discretion over how they treat their poor people, right? And part of this is part of American political culture and the way that we think about people living in poverty and the kinds of policies that we make for them. But it's been baked into Medicaid from the very beginning. And so Medicaid and Medicare actually came from the very same piece of legislation. But the way that that legislation wrote the kind of policy, it set apart Medicare in one way and Medicaid in another. And that was largely a function of who the programs are serving, who their kind of targeted populations were. And when your targeted populations are people that we all feel good about and want to help, well, then you get policy that's more fair and consistent. And when your targeted populations are people that, you know, maybe some of us are suspicious of, we don't think they work hard enough, we don't want them using our taxpayer dollars, we don't want to sort of have them be supporting their quote-unquote dependency or whatever other tropes that we might have about people in need. When those are the targets of the policy, well, then we get very different policy. And that policy tends to not be as consistent or stable or generous.
How, and again, I'm sorry, we're a little bit tangential, but I think it's important because it really sets the table for people. But how racialized was that decision? Was it extremely racialized or just incredibly extremely racialized?
Whichever one is more, incredibly yeah, right. Extremely. I mean, you know, anyone who pays enough attention to U.S. social policy and the history of that policy knows that race is baked into all of these decisions, from the decision makers themselves and what state they came from and what their commitments were based on that, to the policies that were precursors to Medicaid. So before Medicaid emerged, there were lots of policies that were precursors to it that were sort of a beginning. There's a whole chapter in my book about the history of this. And, you know, over time, we're just trying newer and newer ways to target our benefits to the people who we like the most. And Black and brown people are almost never in that category, right? And even when they are in the category, we try to divert benefits away from them, even if they are elderly or they are veterans or they are pregnant women. And that's one of the things that the state flexibility gives us. It means that in places, for example, where
states' rights, right? I mean, I mean, that's basically the whole narrative. States' rights usually means, if not always, means how much are we allowed to discriminate against our people of color is really what it comes down to.
That is exactly right. And that's happened in all domains of social policy, including health policy, from the very beginning of the time that we had any policy. It's impossible even for me to tease out all of the kind of racial threads that can be woven when we think about Medicaid and health policy more generally. It's just ubiquitous. It's always there.
We've talked on this program a decent amount with folks who have written extensively on just the premise of Social Security also being highly racialized. And so, you know, 35 years later, I guess, when they're doing Medicare and Medicaid, it's, what was old is new again and so on. In fact, also, I'm also struck that when we often talk about Medicaid and we talk about Medicaid cuts, the most salient political rhetoric is usually, or the one that gets the most traction, is often the statistic that 2/3 of our elderly who are in nursing homes are there because of Medicaid. So people spend, as you get older, obviously you have less assets. You at one point run out of money and you must go into a nursing home. You become eligible for Medicaid. You get sort of like shuttled from Medicare to Medicaid, and then you're in a nursing home and Medicaid is paying for it. That ends up being a big political talking point because, of the way that we have a structure around the narrative around, I guess, the morality of being poor in this country. Or living in poverty, I should say. All right, well, let's talk about, too, the research that you've done. What are the implications from for this fragmentation on its recipient's perspective on government? Because one of the things that we also have heard is if you are on Medicaid, and one would think it would be different, but it's not, you are less likely to vote. Now, part of that is a function of poverty makes it harder to vote in many respects. But is there more to it than that?
Yes, there's more to it than that. So when I first started looking at some data, and initially it was quantitative data, it was survey data, and I saw this large pattern, Medicaid beneficiaries being less likely to vote. And it made perfect sense to me. These are folks who are living in poverty, and they're just, we know from lots of research, from decades of research, that they're less likely to participate in the political process because there are all sorts of barriers. And so I wasn't terribly surprised about that. But there was a part of me that also wanted to know, does Medicaid itself have anything to do with it? Is it about the nature and the characteristics of the people who are on Medicaid, things like poverty, or is there more to it? And what I found was that there was more to it. And I found that by looking deeper into quantitative data, into survey data, and thinking about how to control for things like poverty and lots of the things that we know are associated with it. And one of the things that I did, for example, was that I looked at a survey called the Fragile Families and Child Wellbeing Survey that has nearly 10,000 people. And many of them, over 50% of them, are Medicaid beneficiaries. So I had lots of a sort of large sample to consider. And I looked at people who took that survey who were Medicaid beneficiaries and people who were not, but who were very similar to each other in many other ways. They were similar in terms of their level of poverty. They were similar in terms of their race, similar in terms of many aspects of their life circumstance. And what I found was that this relationship between Medicaid and not participating in politics as much, not voting and not engaging in other ways, didn't go away, right, as a result of the folks who were Medicaid beneficiaries when compared to their counterparts who were similar in many, many other ways were still less likely to vote, even though the only observable difference between them was being a Medicaid beneficiary. And then what I did was I started talking to a lot of Medicaid beneficiaries to try to figure out, why would this be? Is there something about Medicaid? And what they told me again and again in many different ways, and I talked to beneficiaries from across the country, is that their negative experiences with Medicaid did affect the way that they thought about government and politics and their willingness and desire to participate in politics. And one of the things that the kind of fragmented nature of Medicaid, like we've been talking about, that it's different in different places. Well, Medicaid beneficiaries know this very well. They're the ones who told this to me and brought the sort of the theme of this book to light for me, because they talk about how, their parents in other states or their brothers in other states on Medicaid had one thing and they had another, Or they talk about how much Medicaid changed over time, that 5 years ago they were able to get benefits that they couldn't get now. Or they talk about how they went across, they moved slightly across the border to a different state and figured out they couldn't get something that was hugely important, or that they thought about moving. And when they researched to make sure they'd be able to get life-saving benefits in other states, they found out they wouldn't. And this sends a really clear message. It sends a message that says your value is not, your value and your needs aren't anything that will be responded to on account of you being a member of this broader political community or a citizen of the country. It depends on what state you live in and on how that state feels like treating you. And sometimes it depends on what county you live in, what neighborhood you live in, the kind of experience you have with the program, the kind of access you have to hospitals, to doctors, to benefits. And this kind of motley mix of contingencies, people feel it in their everyday life. And they know what it means. They know that they're the kind of people who aren't guaranteed anything, who aren't protected, even for this most basic set of health benefits. And people read those messages, and they feed those messages into their calculations about whether they should bother taking part in the political system, whether their voices are important and will be heard and responded to. And for the most part, Medicaid beneficiaries don't believe that, although it's worth saying that that varies, that in states that are being generous to beneficiaries, where benefits are consistent and where bureaucracies are well-staffed so that people have positive experiences and where benefits are expanding, we know that participation is more likely to happen, political participation. And in states where those things aren't the case, participation is less likely to happen. So the story isn't that Medicaid makes people not participate in politics. The story is that the kind of experience that people have with the program, which depends on decisions that states and localities make, can affect our democracy, can affect whether the voices of those folks are heard.
Do we see a difference in their for those folks, particularly ones who are, states that are more or less generous, I guess. Do we see any distinction between their voting patterns in federal versus state elections?
So in the data I have, I couldn't distinguish between, for most of the data, I couldn't distinguish between federal and state elections. I could, however, distinguish between state and federal elections and local elections. And what I found is that, you know, the decreased likelihood to participate spans across all of those different kinds of elections. So it's not sort of limited to what's happening at the national level. So it's not as though people are thinking, well, my negative experience with Medicaid, I won't participate in national politics, right? You know, instead, it affects the way people think about politics across the board. Part of it is that some of what's going on is really local, and people are thinking about this in terms of both in terms of their states and in terms of, you know, the federal government, and sometimes even more local than that. And so it affects what people are doing across the board and even beyond voting, like even whether or not people will participate in a local political group or attend a local political meeting, just even the basics of democratic engagement are sort of eroded when people are alienated from the government on account of experiences with getting a very basic benefit, which is healthcare, right? So a lot of people think, I'm not asking you to pay my bills or to give me food. I want to be able to go see a doctor. And if the government doesn't see me as important enough to provide that, then why would I be important enough to participate in politics and to think that that would matter at all, that anyone at any level of government would listen to my voice?
So, I mean, it's a little bit counterintuitive, but the more that you cut Medicaid, the less likely its recipients are going to respond politically in some ways, right? I mean, that's the message being sent to some of these. That answers the question why we have 14 states that don't have an expanded Medicaid.
Yeah, I mean, the research record on this is growing stronger every day. So there are a few studies that came out last year that showed that states that expanded Medicaid in the wake of the Affordable Care Act, that people were more likely to vote immediately in the wake of the expansions, right? So we know that expansion boosts voting, and it boosts voting, especially in places, for example, that have high concentrations of poor people. So we have reason to believe that the boost is coming from the very people who are getting the benefit. And the opposite is also true. When you retract benefits, when you take things away, people are less likely to vote. I show this in the book, and then I also have another paper I wrote, recently wrote with a colleague that will be published soon, that looks at a specific case, looks at Tennessee, because they made huge cuts in the mid-2000s and kicked hundreds of thousands of people off of their Medicaid program pretty quickly and pretty quickly without much warning. So we look at the election before and the election right after to try to see if there'll be any differences that aren't accounted for by lots of other things that we can measure and control for. And what we find is in the wake of a big set of cuts, people are significantly, the aggregate voting rates are significantly lower, right? So, you know, there's more and more evidence in more and more forms, whether it's from talking to people about their experience or looking at different kinds of big quantitative data that shows that, yeah, people are less likely to vote when you take away their benefits. And we would hope for the opposite, that people see that they're losing something important to them and they get out there and they push back. And that they punish their elected officials. And we think that's how democracy should work, that when you take things away from your constituents that harm them, that those constituents will push back and that will end up harming you politically. But that's not the way that it appears to work when it comes to Medicaid. Part of the reason is because, you know, people get alienated. They get discouraged, right, and they get sent very specific messages that they then listen to.
Right. And this is part really of a broader narrative, right? I mean, if you're poor, you deserve to be poor. You're irrelevant. And here is, we're going to cut your Medicaid just to remind you of all those things that we've been trying to signal to you for decades, if not longer.
Yeah.
And so how much do you think? Well, I guess I have two questions about that, about your data. One is, how much do you think there have been politicians who are aware of this dynamic, if not, you know, so specifically in terms of a qualitative sense, but they had an intuition or they had anecdotal sort of evidence of this? A, how much do you think that is the case? B, are you worried that, you know, I'm running for governor in Kentucky? I know what I'm going to do. I'm running for reelect. The way for me to do that, cut benefits. That's going to work for me two different ways, right? It's going to suppress the vote in some areas, and it's going to probably, I'm going to get appreciation from people who don't like people of color, you know, getting, Medicaid phones or whatever it is that they think that they're getting. I mean, how much do you worry about those two dynamics? Obviously, the second one, you're an academic. I understand the mission is to bring out the truth, but I just wonder how much you think this information has been or will be weaponized.
I do worry about that. I think two things. I think the two questions are related. I don't think that to many sort of political folks, this is anything new, right? I think that there's an intuition about these sorts of things that comes from the clear evidence, right? That, for example, they could kick hundreds of thousands of people off Medicaid in Tennessee, and the next election, that governor stays in power, right? And so there's lots of evidence over time that people can take pretty kind of harsh turns against programs like Medicaid and not necessarily suffer many consequences politically. And so I think intuitively or in some way, a lot of elected officials probably suspect this, right?
Right.
I also think that the folks who want to take these benefits away would want to take them away, whether or not it was going to be a political bust or a boon for them, right? So they're likely going to behave the same way, whether they know this or not. It may give them a little bit more glee knowing this.
Right.
But what I focus on more, and one of the things that I try to think about as I, you know, when I think about who to take this research to and who to disseminate it to, is focus on the way we can use information like this for good, right?
Right.
I think for any research that is produced, there are people who can misuse it, who can weaponize it, and there are people who can use it for good. And I think part of what I try to do is think about, you know, what does this mean? There are organizations out there that that mobilize and support Medicaid beneficiaries. It's great for them to know this and to have a sense that one of the ways they can be supporting Medicaid beneficiaries is politically, right? Not just providing them with economic resources, but thinking about helping them register to vote and helping them to be aware of political issues. I've talked to, you know, and spoken with hospital associations, primary care providers, all sorts of folks who say, wow, we never thought about Medicaid in these political terms. And this shapes the way that we want to approach our patients or our clients going forward. So I try to think about who can use this for good to offset the efforts that are right. already going to be made to dampen these folks' voices, you know?
It seems to me the answer to how, what's interesting about this is that from an ideological perspective that, liberals want to create a safety net. Medicaid is an important liberal institution. It was the biggest accomplishment, it seems to me, the expansion of Medicaid was probably the single biggest achievement by the Obama administration, specifically within the context of the ACA. That Medicaid expansion was probably the most important part of it, although I think there's an argument about the patient protections, broadly speaking. But that is considered a liberal solution to this problem, right? We're going to have a we're gonna make sure that we have a safety net for people, but the efficacy of that safety net is inhibited by that perspective and not making it a universal program, right? Because the idea is almost like the way it's a, I mean, I hate to use this as an analogy, but it's the way they hid bad mortgages, right? Ones that had more risk, which is you put it in bigger tranches and it's harder to get at those. So if the idea is that, Medicaid was set up specifically as a separate program from Medicare so that you could cut it, really, right? And diminish the benefits for essentially people of color and more broadly, people living in poverty. The idea is you make a universal program and those people are made safer, that the liberal the liberal agenda is more fulfilled with a more socialistic, for lack of a better word, universal program, right? I mean, this is the best argument for universal health care, it seems to me, in terms of the poor, because it protects that portion of the population as much, if not more, than any, because they're more susceptible to getting their benefits cut.
Yeah, I mean, this is a classic debate among people who are trying to figure out how to help the most needy with social policy. Do we target to them, which often is much more politically feasible because it's less costly, or do we try to create universal programs that cover everyone, which is more politically sustainable because you can't isolate the poor people's programs and try to, pick them off one by one. And it's a classic and difficult dilemma. You know, I think that a kind of universal approach to health policy is preferred, is better, and is, you know, it's a more sort of effective fulfillment of the kind of liberal vision. It's one way of thinking about it, but it should be a more a more effective and more compelling fulfillment of what should be everyone's vision for Americans to be able to be as healthy as possible on terms that are equitable. You know, a lot of people just don't realize that what state you live in, what race you are, how much money you make, these are things that will determine your access to benefits that essentially decide whether you could live or die. I don't actually think that even people who understand themselves, many at least, to be Republicans would say that that's right. Could actually think of a moral grounding for that sort of policy design. I can't fathom what the moral grounding is. There are kind of fiscal and practical grounds, right? Oh, we don't want to, spend this much money. But the moral grounds for the arbitrariness of the whole system, even for many people who are doing everything right and working hard, you just happen to live in the wrong state. And so I think that there's a liberal case to make. I think that there's a human case to make. And I focus on Medicaid in my research because Medicaid is the institution we have. And so let's think about how to make it the best we can. But, you know, in the sort of backdrop for me is always, let's think about how to build new institutions that are more inclusive, more equitable, and more politically and economically sustainable. And that will mean looking beyond Medicaid and looking to a universal system.
Jamila Mishner, the book is Fragmented: Democracy, Medicaid, Federalism, and Unequal Politics. Thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Sam.
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break, head into the fun half of the program, wherein we will have fun and at least a half of a program.
We'll discuss some Bernie compromise and Bernie material, too.
Compromise.
Yeah, we will get to that. Oh, but wait a second. Before we get to that, now look, our fans, our audience of this program are very dedicated, and they start projects, want to make you aware of them when we can and when we're made aware of them. And this one, look, I would not say to support unless you're in a position to easily support. There are certainly more important endeavors out there. However, we would be remiss, and I don't want anyone to accuse us of censoring anybody or of stifling debate. Because this is almost a debate topic, too. Not only is it about a debate, it's almost a debate topic. But apparently, now wait, is this a video?
We have a new video from Bullprog, which is about, it's a song that Dave Rubin should debate Sam Cedar.
Oh, well, I was talking about what I understand was a fundraising. Do we have a link to that?
It's in the sound polls.
Okay. Now, why don't we play the song? We'll play the song after we show this. Michael just informed me.
I was informed of this in the, there's a special channel in the TMBS Discord called the Open Exchange Channel. And this came to me as a special breaking alert for an ideas forum.
Now, that's not my favorite picture. But beggars can't.
I think for purposes of this, I think they went in the right creative direction.
That's fine. That's fine. There is a GoFundMe entitled "Debate Sam Cedar Billboard in Los Angeles." There is an image of a billboard. Apparently, it's a picture of Dave Rubin and a picture of me, and it says, "Dave, you can't hide forever. Debate Sam." And we scroll down. Let me read what it says here. We are trying to raise awareness of the fact that that political commentator Dave Rubin is still ducking Sam Cedar for a long overdue debate. We will be purchasing a billboard in Los Angeles near the home of the Rubin Report to bring attention to this crisis. Billboard design is not final. Okay, there you go. Please offer suggestions in the comments. And how much are they looking to raise? How much does it cost to get a billboard in Los Angeles? $4,000. Now they've made it to a 76. Now they don't get to pocket this money. This is one of those things, like, it's got to be they make the goal, right?
I think on GoFundMe it's a you make the goal. Or
no,
you,
oh, I, it think, isn't. I think I think Kickstarter is you have to make the goal, but GoFundMe I think it whatever you get.
Yeah. Wow. Is there a? I mean,
that's pretty.
Wait,
awesome.
Wait a second. Are we sure that this is real? That someone's going to actually like?
Hey,
I don't want anybody.
If you're doing this and it's fake, stop it.
Yeah, you stop that right call now. If this is fake,
Chris Johnson from Queens, call into the show today.
Queens. We'll go out there and find you. We'll get on.
Yeah, I think you should make a commitment that if it does, if you don't get to the goal, then you'll become
maximum patron levels of all of our shows.
Right. If you don't get to the goal, right? Oh yeah, yeah. You gotta do the billboard. I think that's. I just want to say, I think it's childish, and I think it's obnoxious, and I think it's certainly in keeping with the spirit of the discourse that Dave and I have. And so,
That is certainly true.
It would be super funny.
Oh, we just didn't want to suppress this guy's ideas. Yeah. Is the bottom line.
That would be super, super funny. But let's just round it out with a left is best. Dave Rubin should debate Sam Cedar by Bull Prog. We'll head into the fun half.
This Thursday instead of Tuesday, TMBS. Thursday,
right.
Starting at 6.
State of the Union this week.
No,
we thought it was
going to
be.
But it was all scheduled anyway. So Bill Fletcher Jr. on the Sudan uprisings. We'll talk about Venezuela. Unlocked illicit history of the BJP RSS and how it leads to the Tulsi Gabbard candidacy. Become a patron, patreon.com/TMBS. Literally a few tickets left if you want to come Friday on the homepage.
Also, you can support this program by becoming a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. Don't forget, too, that justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. Literary Hangover.
House of the Seven Gables exported last night for YouTube. It'll be up this afternoon.
All right, folks, see you in the fun half.
I saw your subreddit, and they seemed sort of angry. I don't know.
Well, I don't even want to get into that. There were that wasn't my my own thing. All right,
oh, really?
Yeah, it doesn't matter. Hey, Dave, this is a very brave move on your part. Kudos. Have you heard about the SJW nonsense on the?
Dave Rubin is going to absolutely need to be exposed.
Look, I encourage all of you to go fan trolling of Dave Rubin.
Competition would start kicking in.
There was a video, and then there was like 14 videos. So a lot of people made mixes of this.
Our friends, creative, awesome people on YouTube, basically everybody.
We got a ton. And here's another blah, blah, blah. Debate Sam Cedar. Blah, blah, blah. Debate Sam Cedar. Blah,
blah, blah. Why don't you just run to your safe space, Dave? Blah, blah, blah.
Debate Sam Cedar. Blah, blah, blah. Debate Sam Cedar.
Fucked up again. Damn it.
Pause it. I just want to say, Dave, I do respect you.
It's going to be good, folks.
Not.
How can you say that?
It's funny.
Yes!
Jesus.
Yeah. Left is best. Left is best. Left is best. Left
is best. Left is best. Left is best. Left is best. Who's laughing now, Sam?
Just a reminder, it is your support that makes the show possible. Does not get less mature than this, folks.